We would like to thank Jones Benali for being on Indigenous Youth Nation.
Indigenous Youth Nation was created by executive producer Janita Benali. The program was edited and mixed at Radio Camp by senior producer Greg McVicker. Our awesome youth team of hosts, editors, and overall coolness quality control were Eshki, Tyler, Dahi, Bahia, Deji, Bahajoni, Mia Dove, and Gowani Hatla. Original theme music by Seahawson. Project sponsor, Amanda Eichstad of KWMR. And thanks to Becky Berryhill of the Native Media Resource Center. Major support was provided by a grant from the Joan Gans Cooney Center at Sesame Workshop, with additional support from the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress. Big thanks to our guests, Brian Young, John Fenn, Sage Bond, and Joan Spinelli. And thank you for listening. We want to hear your feedback. This is episode number one. Want to be featured in a future show? Find us at indigenousyouthnation.com. This is Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Greetings, I'm Ansa Craiglin.
And I'm Winston Watson.
And I'm Donald Clark.
And we are The Meditation.
We are listening to community radio.
KBOO
90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon.
Yeah. Dig it.
Here at KBOO, we honor the indigenous people whose traditional and ancestral homelands we stand on. The Multnomah, Kathlamet, Clackamas, Tomwater, Wetlala Bands of the Chinook, the Tualatin Kalapuya, and many other indigenous tribes and nations of the region of the Willamette River and that great river known as Shwaneku, Wimal, Nishaiwana, and Columbia. Many names for the living water force that has sustained this region for countless generations and provided phenomenal life to our blessed ecosystems. We believe it is important to acknowledge the ancestors of this land and to recognize that we are here because of the sacrifices forced upon them. In remembering these communities, we honor their legacy, their lives, and their descendants with the forming of relationships to each other and the living world.
Today's show includes information about how indigenous peoples of the Oregon coast used native plants. Traditional methods of safely cooking and processing these plants allowed tribal groups to safely handle and consume them. Without this knowledge, attempting to process and eat these plants could cause you harm. Enjoy the show, but do not attempt to replicate any of these methods or consume any plants discussed here.
One, two.
Welcome to Beyond Your Front Door, your adventure guide to the Central Oregon coast. I'm very pleased to be in the studio today with author Patty Wereat Phillips. Patty is the author of Ethnobotany of the Coos, Lower Umpqua, and Siuslaw Indians, and we'll be talking about the inspiration behind her book, as well as the important cultural and historical uses of plants here along the Central Oregon coast. Patty, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
I'm super excited that you're here. Before we begin, can you tell me a bit about yourself and your background?
Yeah, I grew up in Coos Bay, actually on the east side of the bay, up Kentuck Slough. We lived on a hill above a swampy draw. So I spent pretty much every summer of my childhood chasing after every berry that came ripe. You know, so salmon berries were the first ones. They'd be ripe early June, you know, when school was still in session. So when I'd be walking back from the bus, you know, I could just snack on salmon berries and then thimbleberries as they came on. And as summer went on, you know, I'd first chase after the native blackberries because they're at least they used to be ripe in early July, and with the climate change, you know, everything's moving around, so it's getting confusing. But that's what I used to chase after, the native blackberry, and a few weeks later, the Himalaya blackberry. I'd be picking them like crazy. We were also lucky in that we had a couple of really nice patches of red huckleberry.
Ooh.
And those take a lot of work to pick because they're so small, but they're really good. I remember one year my mom made this lovely scarlet jelly.
That sounds wonderful. You know, I love those native blackberries. They are so good. I walk all over my neighborhood. I know everywhere where there's little patches of them, and I never tell any of my friends where they are. They're hard
almost
to find.
Almost as bad as gold. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Annoying.
They are so good. Well, Patty, I really love your book, Ethnobotany of the Coos, Lower Umpqua, and Siuslaw Indians. And I'm wondering if you can tell me what inspired you to write this book.
Well, one thing as a kid, I didn't really have much of an interest in plants other than the berries I could eat. And I liked to watch all the critters that came around. We had a pretty good deer population, and they trusted us enough that they would often bring their fawns around, which was adorable. Love little spotted fawns.
Aww.
And all the birds, and my mom in particular would maintain these bird feeders, you know, with seeds, and that's the hummingbird feeders. So we had lots of animals. So I was really fascinated with the animals. And that kind of led me to then go on to Oregon State University, study biology, and I focused on animal biology, and I think I mentioned it in the book, botany was a struggle. I do remember having one botany class and trying to look at plant tissues under a microscope, and I couldn't tell one tissue from the other. I was just really exasperated. So I didn't really think about ethnobotany much till years later. I mean, the next thing I did after studying biology, I got a bachelor's in biology. I'd also had a long-standing interest in the native languages because when I was a small child growing up in the 70s, I never heard anybody using any native words. I mean, I knew, you know, there used to be another language, not English, but I never heard any words. I was kind of curious about it. In the early 80s, my dad had started acquiring a lot of sources, you know, a lot of paperwork, these ancient, you know, well, to me, ancient linguistic and anthropological paperwork, notes by linguists from the 40s and the 30s and even earlier. And of course, linguistics uses its own symbols to represent sounds in a language. So when I'm looking at these papers, a lot of the symbols were very unfamiliar. So I got very curious about them. And I finally decided if I was ever going to figure out how to say these words and what they meant, I would need to study linguistics. So I wound up starting the linguistics program at the University of Oregon in 93. And graduated in 96. And ever since then, I've been working off and on over the years on our tribe's languages, which we have three of them just to make life complex. On Coos Bay, there's actually two related but distinct languages, Honus and Miluk. And then the Siuslaw and Lower Umpqua people actually spoke dialects of the same language. And Honus was the best documented, so I've worked on that the most. But here in recent years, I've been working also a lot more on Miluk and Siuslaw as well. Siuslaw is quite the delightful challenge. It has something like more than 100 suffixes, so that's a lot.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah, I wound up getting interested in ethnobotany because when I was working in the cultural department for the tribe back in the late 90s, there was a University of Oregon student that wrote to the tribe asking about medicinal plants, and that was just not a subject I'd ever thought of before. So I was kind of curious, like, oh, that's an interesting question. I'm going to see what I can find out about that. And very quickly ran into this irritating wall in that I found there hadn't been much published on medicinal plants or any aspect of ethnobotany for Western Oregon tribes. I found none of the anthropologists or linguists or ethnographers who'd passed through over the 100-plus years they'd been coming around had a particular interest in plants. Sometimes it would come up in discussions about food. One person, Melville Jacobs, did ask a lot about baskets from a weaver, luckily. But information about plants tended to be pretty scattered. And so what I did is I was putting all the information in the spreadsheet. You know, just as I'd find something, I'd grab that information and plomp it, you know, in the spreadsheet. And I talked to some of the elders, too, which is fun. You know, some cultural practices died out early on and some persisted quite a bit. I noticed, besides, you know, berries, a lot of native teas, people had never stopped using those, and some of the native greens, you know, people would collect those. And then I did learn from my older cousins, I always thought this was so funny, that the ancestor, who was pretty much universally known as Grandma Mom, her name was Frances Talbot Elliott, she lived well into her 90s, so you know, she was well known to a lot of grandchildren and great grandchildren. And she would make a cold medicine by taking a little bit of the root of skunk cabbage and grinding it up and mixing it with some honey to make it more palatable and give it to kids as a cold medicine.
Wow.
And and apparently that was kind of peppery. I'm like, oh my, I'll bet it was. Because normally how you use skunk cabbages, you have to cook it. I mean, this was something I thought was interesting as I did my research. Skunk cabbage is a member of the arum family. It's actually a distant cousin to taro, which is a widely grown root vegetable throughout the South Pacific and parts of mainland Asia. And both taro and skunk cabbage have these calcium oxalate crystals in them. So it's actually very dangerous to bite into like a skunk cabbage leaf or the skunk cabbage root or a taro root unless it's been cooked, because you have to break down those crystals. So they'll cause the mucous membranes of the mouth and throat to swell up. But there is something about skunk cabbage. I did look it up in an herbalist book. It is supposed to help with chest colds. But yeah, it's like, cook it first.
Yeah,
it's going to break down those crystals. But yeah, grandma and mom had this kind of scary medicine that the kids did not like. And I thought that was pretty funny.
Well, I can tell you, after smelling skunk cabbage, I would be probably terrified as well. But very interesting. Well, Patty, I'm wondering, we've been talking a little bit about some of the uses of these plants. Can you just provide a quick definition of the term ethnobotany to make sure everybody listening understands?
Yeah, basically, it's where the study of human cultures, so anthropology, meets botany. So it's how does a particular culture interact or use plants? So you can see that that's pretty broad, because, you know, growing wine grapes, the different wines, you know, that people have made for thousands of years, that falls under the umbrella of ethnobotany. Breeding different varieties of wheat and making bread, that's ethnobotany. Then for the Pacific Northwest, you know, a lot of folks don't usually put a lot of thought into how indigenous cultures used plants, maybe beyond, you know, cedar canoes and cedar plank houses, because the view is, you know, it's a fishing culture, which isn't totally inaccurate. You know, I mean, salmon,
right,
and also lamprey, and then on the coast, a lot of other fishes are very, very important, you know, historically and today, but it's not the whole picture. The green world, the plant world, was really important also, and so it's just kind of fun to try and bring out some of that information that a lot of people just weren't very aware of.
Yeah, you know, your book really does a great job of that. Can you expand a bit on how the languages and people are related?
Well, culturally, the people are very related. It's the language and culture situation of Western Oregon is pretty complex. And the Coos Bay, Lower Umpqua, Sayusla, Alsi, Nequina people are all kind of sandwiched in the middle between two different very language groups and cultures. Though to the north are the Tillamook people. They are usually identified as the southernmost of the Salish language speakers. So the Salish language family is a large language family concentrated mostly in Washington and British Columbia. There are some interior Salish languages in eastern Washington, Idaho, and Montana. And then to the south of us, so beginning, like say, in the upper Coquille watershed and all the way down through Curry County into Northern California and Smith River, as well as some interior folks like the upper Umpqua of Roseburg vicinity, spoke Athabascan, which is yet another completely different unrelated language family. Most of the Athabascan languages are actually concentrated in Alaska and the adjacent bit of northwestern Canada. There's another branch of Athabascan folks, well, in California, like the Hoopa and Sinkione and Matole, and then out in the desert southwest, the Navajo and Apache peoples are also Athabascan. So it's a pretty large language family. And then smushed in the middle is us, and nobody knows quite what to do with our languages. They're a bit odd.
Interesting.
Yeah, right now we're in a bit of a junk pile category, I call it. Mostly we're labeled right now the Coastal Oregon Penutian. There is a language family called Penutian that is mostly concentrated in Oregon and California, and then kind of an interior Oregon, Klamath Modoc, Takalma, Kalapuya, Sahaptin, you know, along the Columbia River, I think Nez Perce. And then there's us on the coast. It's like, well, maybe you guys are Panutian, but possibly not.
Wow, that's really interesting.
Our languages apparently do have a fairly heavy Salish influence on them, but aren't at their core Salish. And that's just probably from centuries of sustained contact with the Tillamook, because there was a lot of trade there, also sometimes warfare. The Tillamooks did have a rather naughty habit of trying to come down and kidnap people and then sell them into slavery on the Columbia River. So
that's not good.
No, not great. Yeah, so the Siuslaw-Umpqua language, as best I can tell, is not super closely related to anything else. It's a bit closer to Alsi-Yequenna than it is to the two Coos Bay languages. But I think at their core, they are distantly related, you know, going back a few thousand years. And then, of course, it gets complicated because these language communities were in constant contact. You know, they travel back and forth all the time to trade, to intermarry. One huge gathering spot, particularly between the Hana-speaking communities of Coos Bay and the Huich, the Lurumpa people, was around the Ten Mile Lake. It used to be there was a lot of Wapato that grew there. That's a food plant. So there'd be big gatherings there, as well as used to be a really good salmon and lamprey fishing place. And so there was a lot of language that went back and forth, because I'll find words, especially in the Kuich dialect as opposed to the Siuslaw dialect, that appear to come out of Honus, but then there's some influence coming back the other way from Umpqua Siuslaw into the Coos languages. So it's just really interesting to kind of see these influences, you know, in terms of like language and plant use, because of course a lot of the uses of the plants were very similar between these cultures.
That's fascinating. And you know, Patty, the next question I have for you was to ask you about some of the key historical or cultural pieces of information that you would like to share from your book, because I'll tell you, the first 25 pages of your book it's pretty amazing. Everybody should read that information. And I really just learned so much about the important history of indigenous peoples here on the Central Coast from your book. And I'm wondering, is there some key information that you'd like to share, or are we saving that for another show?
It would probably be a whole show in itself.
That's what I'm thinking. So what I'm wondering is, would you be interested in coming back on the show?
Yeah, that would be great.
Okay, great. It sounds like, from what you just said, the Coos, Lower Umpqua, and Siuslaw peoples used plants in a similar way. Is that true?
Locally here among these tribes, it was more similar than not. There are subtle differences as you go over a certain distance. Like, I know in Northern California, they will use willow sticks a lot in stick baskets. But as you move north, I'm not sure exactly where the switch happens, but somewhere in Curry County, and then certainly from Coos Bay to Siuslaw, they tended to prefer hazel sticks over willow sticks for stick basketry. So it is kind of like these subtle shifts of cultural preference. And another one that also goes back to basketry is, if you look at baskets with designs, it's pretty common to see, you know, white and black overlays. The white is pretty much always bear grass, but the black overlay can be many different things. And again, if you go into Northern California and then the Athabascan-speaking peoples of southwestern Oregon, they tend to use maidenhair fern for the black overlay. At Coos Bay, it switches where using eelgrass is dominant for the black overlay in baskets. Then with bark skirts, from Northern California up to Coos Bay, Lower Umpqua region, women tended to make their nice skirts from the inner bark of the big leaf maple. You can go further north, so by the time you get to the Alsi people, it's mostly the inner bark of red cedar. So Siuslaw is kind of in an interesting transitional zone. You have a lot of maples there in the Siuslaw country, and of course a lot of red cedars too, so you would probably find a mix of skirt type. And of course there was a fair bit of intermarriage, you know, not only with the Lower Umpqua people to the south, but also with the Alsi people to the north, even though some cultural things didn't make the jump very often between Siuslaw and Alsi, because Alsis are the southernmost people to regularly practice head flattening, and the Siuslaw people didn't do that. There's only a handful of Siuslaw people in the old days that had flattened heads, and usually that was because they had an Alsi mother.
Interesting.
Who really wanted to make sure their kid had the fancy sloped forehead. So there was a bit of teasing back and forth. You know, they'd call us the seal heads. which I'm fine with. I think seals are cute.
Yeah, they are adorable.
The bread heads after like flat bread, so kind of funny.
Well, one of the things that was super interesting to me was to learn how indigenous peoples actually cultivated introduced crops. For example, potatoes. Of both introduced crops and native plants, which plants were most widely cultivated and how they practiced land management techniques to encourage the growth of desired plants?
You know, we kind of have to speculate a bit on some of it because there has been some really good research that was done on this in British Columbia, Western Washington, and also California. With Western Oregon, you know, so early on, people got decimated by the epidemics, and then so many of the Western Oregon tribes were forcibly removed from their homeland. So a lot of knowledge about these traditional practices didn't get passed on, at least not as much as in neighboring areas. Yeah, what we do know is tobacco was widely cultivated throughout the region. In fact, it seemed to be the most babied of the plants, like it needed the most help. And they would put the most effort into growing it.
Interesting.
So locally, they would burn a patch, scatter the tobacco seeds in there, and then surround the patch with like brush fences to keep the wind off of it so that the tobacco could grow nicely. You know, the practices were fairly similar apparently throughout the Northwest. And I did read one anthropologist's paper. She was talking about early adoption of growing potatoes among the Haida and the Tlingit, you know, from British Columbia and coastal Alaska. And she thought that because these people already had a long-standing tradition of growing tobacco, it was very easy to just kind of take that knowledge and apply it to potatoes. And potatoes was also one of the early crops introduced here. There is a note from an Indian agent in the 1850s that the Little Umpqua people were already growing them along the Smith River. Now, I have read in some places there's also heavy cultivation of springbank clover, and that could have been true in our area also. Camas also seemed to have some horticultural techniques added to it, and it must have worked well because another paper I was reading was talking about a study of camas ovens near Salem that were about 10,000 years old.
Wow.
You know, you go in the Willamette Valley, and of course, a lot of other valleys, Umpqua Valley, Camas Valley. Camas still grows pretty thick in places to this day. So then it makes you really stop and think, like, wow, you know, cultivating camas was so successful that it was an ongoing thing for at least 10 millennia and probably older than that, you know, because that just happened to be some of the older ovens that had been found and had gotten some burnt bulbs out of it to do, you know, some carbon dating, carbon 14 dating.
So interesting. You know, do you feel that some of the practices might have altered some of the landscape here on the coast?
That's what most of the anthropologists think, because, you know, people were living here for thousands of years, and one of the common land management techniques throughout the whole West, actually, and East, too, is burning. So
right.
What they would do is every fall, typically after the first rain, they'd do these burns, and normally they'd be low-temperature burns. It would burn down that year's annual plant growth, and the hope was, of course, to encourage new growth come the spring. It would also tend to have the effect of kind of discouraging the spread of Douglas firs and other conifers into meadows.
Right.
You know, so it would keep these open meadows century after century. And then again, with these fires typically being low temperature, the mature trees would be safe because they can shrug off low temperature fires. So you'd have this interesting ecological mix, you know, of some old growth forests and then all these meadows. I mean, they do talk about going hunting and having miles of open country where it's easier to see deer. Sometimes it's reflected in the place name, like just north of Florence, there's a place called Clover Ridge, and its Siuslaw name is Sahautita, and it comes from the Siuslaw word Sahauya, meaning grass or brush, and it is in an area that was like part of a traditional round of deer hunting. So probably, you know, based on the name, you just kind of figure, yeah, that place was probably burned regularly, was very open, and then it kind of lives on in English with the Clover Ridge. There's probably a lot of grasses and clover that was good deer and elk browse, and then later good horse browse. Well, you look at pictures of that place today, and it's conifer forest. with a few roads punched through it,
right.
You know, because the fires have been suppressed now since the 19th century. So it's a major ecological shift.
Yeah, so interesting. Patty, one of my favorite parts of the show is asking people to share a favorite memory or story. And I'm wondering, do you have a favorite memory or story that you can share about writing or researching your book?
It has been fun over the years to be able to talk to elders, you know, about going out and gathering teas, just kind of their experiences. But maybe one of my favorite plants is skunk cabbage, because it's just so weird. I grew up above a swampy draw. I was on a hill. Down below us, there's two streams that came down these narrow draws and joined up. So it was very swampy down there. Every spring, these vivid yellow, weirdly shaped plants would pop up out of the mud. And their smell never bothered me because I grew up with it. You know, I know some people find it too strange or kind of unpleasant. I never found it unpleasant. Weird, yes, but not unpleasant.
Yeah, I think weird is probably correct, especially because
there's
they're
nothing
so
quite like it.
They're just so beautiful. Like the first time I saw a skunk cabbage, I was like, oh my gosh, that's the most beautiful flower. I take photos of them all the time. And I went to smell it, of course, you know, the very first time. And I was just surprised, right? Like you would not expect that.
Yeah, and it's just a bizarre plant. And there's nothing else that looks quite like it. And then partly that's because there aren't many of its plant family, the arums, in our area. It's mostly, from what I found, a tropical and subtropical family.
That's why. That makes sense.
But yeah, they're so wonderfully odd. And then kind of discovering that they can be eaten, but they have to be processed correctly. Because like a lot of foods, if you don't process it correctly, it's not safe to eat. At some point long ago, people figured out how to cook it properly. And I love how it appears in stories. It was important enough that it actually does appear in some stories throughout the Northwest. At Coos Bay, it appears in the Trickster Epic, where the first of the tricksters, he offended the salmon, and so he had no salmon to eat. And he's like, oh boy, what am I going to do now for food? So he grabs a skunk cabbage root, and he tries to eat it, and he's like, blah! So then, in a fit of pique, he just shoves it in the hot ashes of a fire and then takes a little nap. And then when he wakes up, he's like, oh, something smells nice. And he takes out the skunk cabbage from the ashes and it's all cooked. And now he starts taking it apart. And then with each piece he sets out, he names a different kin. Like, oh, give this to your mother. Give this to your father. Give this to your paternal uncle. Give this to your paternal aunt. And so on and so forth, basically kind of creating... when human beings come in the world, you know, this is how their families are going to be. You know, they're going to have moms, they're going to have dads, and they're going to have aunties and uncles and so on and so forth. And so it's just kind of an interesting thing that, you know, skunk cabbage was like, aha, one of the first foods. And he's like, okay, this is when human beings come, this is what they will do.
Wow.
They will put skunk cabbage in hot ashes. And human beings will have kinship. And this is going to be their name. And then I also love it in that it appears in a story about the little people, because the little people use the leaves as tents.
Oh.
And so kids always enjoy those stories when you tell them, okay, you know, if you happen to see a skunk cabbage leaf stuck on a stick, that's a little person's tent, and you know they've been around there.
I love that. That's great. Those are fabulous stories. I can see why that would be your favorite plant, for sure, or at least one of them.
Yeah, because it's got stories and it's just plain weird. And I love weird plants.
Yeah. You know, I think this is a good time for people who maybe tuned in late and are hearing these fabulous stories. I just want to let people know that you've been listening to Beyond Your Front Door. We've been coming to you from beautiful downtown Florence, Oregon, and I've been having a lot of fun speaking with Patty Wereat Phillips. She is the author of Ethnobotany of the Coos, Lower Umpqua, and Siuslaw Indians. We've been talking about the historical and cultural uses of plants among indigenous peoples of the Oregon coast. We've also been talking about the different languages, farming practices, and cultural traditions related to early life on the coast. If you missed any portion of this show, you can find the entire show on my playlist at soundcloud.com. Just search for Beyond Your Front Door Oregon and look for the Crashing Wave. Patty, we are just about out of time. Is there anything else that you would like to add before we wrap up?
It's been great to see kind of a renaissance in the tribes with some aspects of culture, because like I mentioned, we never quit going out and collecting wild teas and berries, but basketry, you know, people had for a period kind of stopped weaving. And certainly when I was young in the 70s and 80s, I don't remember seeing traditional weavers, but now there's been quite a renaissance and there are so many young people now taking up weaving, and it's been wonderful to see, you know, wonderful to see what they create, you know, because each basket is individual and unique and very beautiful.
Yeah, that's great. Well, Patty, thank you so much for taking time to be here today. Again, I love your book and I'm so excited to have you on the show. And I look forward to having you come back to talk about some of the history of the indigenous peoples that lived here on the Central Coast. I think that will also be a great show. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Listeners who use information from this program to venture outdoors do so at their own risk. Outdoor activities may be hazardous and must be carefully evaluated for each listener based on that person's circumstances. KXCR and the individuals involved in this program, Pacifica Radio, or any station airing this program do not assume any liability from the use of any information presented. By using this information to enjoy your own coastal adventures, you assume all potential risks and agree to hold Pacifica Radio, KXCR, its affiliates, any station airing this program, and the presenters harmless from any resulting liability. Thanks to Pacifica Radio member stations for airing Beyond Your Front Door, including Pacific Northwest Radio, KXCR, KBOO, KXCJ, and KCEI. And thanks to local band Jumpin' the Rails for their rendition of Smith Chapel, the theme song used on this show. And last but never least, thanks to each of you for joining me this week on another coastal adventure. I hope you have a great week and get some time beyond your front door.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Hey, Michael here. I'm with the Tin Can Phone Podcast, a radio show where you can hear about the influence